This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we speak with John Bellamy Foster about his new book, Trump in the White House, Tragedy and Farce.
Back in 1935, Bertolt Brecht, the German playwright, said, "How can anyone tell the truth about fascism unless he is willing to speak out against capitalism, which brings it forth?" And that's what John Bellamy Foster does. Listen in.
We talk with the author of a new book, Democracy in Chains, The Deep History of the Radical Right's Stealth Plan for America.
Nancy McClain puts it all together. This is like a evolving coup that's going on now. The bad guys are halfway there.
Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Stephen Smith.
And I'm New York City attorney and activist Heidi Boghossian.
The great issues of our times are the return of fascism to the United States and Europe, climate change, and the stagnation of the world capitalist economy. These great issues are pressing and interconnected. We used to think that the experience of World War II guaranteed that no politician would ever advocate the ideas of fascism. But the election of Donald Trump a year ago has caused a serious reconsideration of fascism and its relationship to capitalism and to democracy. The neoliberals paved the way for Trump. Now he and the forces aligned with him have put our democratic institutions under attack in order to protect the rule of the wealthy. The attacks include the right to vote, labor unions, public education, an independent news media, independent public universities, the privatization of much of traditional governmental functions, and making it almost impossible to launch a new political party. The election of Trump is a political development that, for concrete sociological reasons, allows us to see it for what it is, as a type of neo-fascism. Only by identifying the phenomena correctly can we effectively fight it. Jack London wrote a century ago in his famous book, The Iron Heel, that, quote, "There is a shadow of something colossal and menacing that even now is beginning to fall across the land. Call it the shadow of an oligarchy, if you will. It is the nearest I dare approximate it. What its nature may be, I refuse to imagine. But what I want to say is this. You are in a perilous position." We speak today with John Bellamy Foster, the editor of the magazine Monthly Review, about his new book, Trump in the White House, Tragedy and Farce. Foster is a professor of sociology at the University of Oregon. He has written widely on political economy and has established a reputation as a major environmental sociologist. John Bellamy Foster, welcome back to Law and Disorder.
Glad to be here.
Donald Trump has brought together white supremacists, Christian fundamentalists, neo-fascists, and capitalist billionaires. You've subtitled your book, Tragedy and Farce. In this collection, can you tell us what do you mean by tragedy?
Well, the combination of white supremacists, Christian fundamentalists, neo-fascists, and capitalist billionaires is certainly a tragedy in the political sphere, but that's not what I meant by tragedy. What I meant was something more complex and fundamental, and that is the U.S. economy began slowing down its growth rate. What we call economic stagnation actually began in the mid-1970s. And has worsened up to today, particularly with the great financial crisis. And the response of the system was the generation of neoliberalism, which was a kind of austerity approach. That has ultimately been unsuccessful, and the economy is stagnating even more. And what we're seeing is a hard turn to the right, a growth of neo-fascism, as a result of this larger structural crisis of the system. This is a tragedy because the society keeps on turning to the right, turning the screws on the population rather than addressing its fundamental problems.
From a broader sociological perspective, who brought Trump into the White House, and what is his social base?
Well, if you look just at the election and you look at it from an economic standpoint, which is always useful, and from a class standpoint, you find that Trump won a plurality of votes in the 50,000 people with incomes of $50,000 to $200,000. Those are family incomes. The bottom 50% of the population cutoff is around $56,000. So you're basically, what in economic terms, Trump support mainly came from the lower middle class, primarily, not from the extremely wealthy, and certainly not from the working class. Although segments of the working class, particularly more privileged elements, voted for him, and his vote, of course, came predominantly from the white population, which the lower middle class is predominantly white, and it came from religious. The more religious parts of the population, and more rural parts of the population, and the less educated. So you get a pretty clear picture. One thing that I find significant is of those who said that they had lost income in the previous 4 years. Who'd done financially worse in the 4 years previously under Obama, 77% of those voted for Trump. So there's a very strong economic aspect to all of this, a class aspect. And it isn't really the white working class, as is commonly said.
Making a parallel with fascism in Germany under Hitler, did Hitler enjoy the same kind of social base, lower middle class, that Trump gets here in the United States?
The base was very, very similar. The political base is very similar, and this was noted by Gallup shortly before the election. They based on their poll data, but Hitler's support came primarily from the lower middle class. It came from religious Protestants, not Catholics. It came from rural sectors. It came from those who wanted an expansion of the military. But it's very, very similar, particularly the lower middle class base. In U.S. politics, the politics has been geared, the Republican Party politics has essentially been defined by the capitalist class. It's basically the Republican politics, although they have appealed to people who are down and out and the bottom, and people who have racist and chauvinistic views. The politics has really been defined by the top and the leading economic interests. The Democrats have traditionally tried to create an alliance between the upper middle class and the working class, but the politics has been defined pretty much by the upper middle class. To have a political movement that's actually based on the lower middle class is historically understood as quite dangerous, because the lower middle class, especially in our period, they are suffering economically. They're downwardly mobile. They are often feel rage towards the working class, and particularly the lower elements of the working class that are always the racially oppressed. And they tend to ally themselves with the very top monopoly capital, the financial elite, financial capital, but they rage against aspects of the system. So they're a very dangerous and volatile political base for any political movements, the state, and this is where fascism, in its various forms, has traditionally come from.
John, the title of your book is Trump in the White House, Tragedy and Farce, and I wanted to ask you about the farcical aspects of his regime. I mean, after all, these people deny human-caused climate change.
Yeah, well, I think that there's so many farcical aspects that with Trump's tweets that it's we could come up with a very long list. But I would put at the very top that the rejection of science with respect to climate change, actually all aspects of science are being essentially denied. And this is something that I never really expected to see in the political system in the United States, but the very systematic rejection of climate change for clearly economic reasons is a kind of farce. It's basically putting your head in the sand, ostrich-like. We see all sorts of aspects of this, and I think though we should not emphasize the farcical aspects too much. And then it's easy to see some people say, "Well, Trump is a clown," but I think it's much more serious than that. The way I define him in the very beginning of my book, and the book isn't so much about him as it is about the political changes that are associated with him. The way I define him in the beginning of the book is he made a statement where he could stand in the middle of the street in Manhattan and shoot somebody. He said this in a half-jokingly way, and he wouldn't lose any votes. And what that is a statement that he can act with impunity without facing any consequences. To have that kind of a president in the White House is a very frightening thing.
John, can you talk a bit about his advisors, especially some of the members in his cabinet?
Well, of course, in my book, the advisor that I focused on the most was Steve Bannon, who's now gone, but still has a very, very interesting and important relation to the Trump administration. But, you know, right now his advisors consist of, there's John Kelly, who really represents the hard right. He's been coming out of the military, but very, very hard right positions. Stephen Miller, who is a key advisor, speech writer for Trump. He's really a very important figure in this, and he comes from Breitbart, of course. And there's Jeff Sessions represents a kind of combination of white supremacism, Christian fundamentalism, and neo-fascism in himself. The administration is dominated now by generals. A columnist recently called this a benign junta, but it's very worrisome. The U.S. government has traditionally been under civilian leadership, and it doesn't bode well in terms of our foreign wars. Jim Mattis, who's Secretary of Defense, his nickname is Mad Dog Mattis, and there's every reason for concern in terms of Trump's advisors. Although Bannon is out and is sort of playing a role, in a way, a very supportive role of in terms of a hard turn to the right outside the administration, we still have people who raise the question of neo-fascism within the administration. And, of course, Trump himself raises it constantly.
John, you write that fascism is one of the two major means of political management adopted by ruling classes in advanced capital states. Can you explain this, please?
Well, we consider the traditional form of management of the state under capitalism has been what we call liberal democracy, what political theorists call the system of liberal democracy. Liberalism in its classical meaning is more like what we think of neoliberalism. Liberalism means sort of possessive individualism on the market, free market individualism, that sort of thing is traditionally, in the classical sense, liberalism was a market ideology, very much opposed to democracy, and which democracy was associated with the rule of the poor or the rule of the masses. But what evolved in the late 19th century and the 20th century was a system called liberal democracy, which was seen as kind of a centrist political system that kind of an amalgamation of liberal views in the market and democratic views and basically erected around the vote and so on. And this is, a liberal democracy is usually controlled by the political elites traditionally, and it's a system that works very well with capitalism. But capitalism has been in a deepening crisis for some time. To understand how serious the problem is, that is, Larry Summers recently came out with a chart showing that the trends in the economic growth, and by 2012, according to current trends, the growth rate of the economy since the Great Financial Crisis or the Great Recession will have been lower in that 12 years than the 12 years following the stock market crash in 2009. In 1929, stock market crash in 1929. So, in other words, the economy will be more stagnant over a 12-year period than what it was following the onset of the Great Depression.
John Bellamy Foster, you've recently had published the book Trump in the White House, Tragedy and Farce, and I read the entire book in the last couple of days. I have to say this is a really fine contribution, and I would urge everybody to get Trump in the White House. Say that Trump has secured a beachhead in the White House, but there are still loose ends, you write, that need to be tied up. And from their point of view, what loose ends are we talking about? What do they need to do?
Well, they came in like gangbusters. Remember, and Bannon was the brains behind it. I know Trump wouldn't like that, but they were talking in terms of the deconstruction of the administrative state. It was a period of what was called Gleichschaltung in Germany under the Nazis. It paralleled that. Basically, it's not the same. This is neo-fascism. It's not the fascism that existed in Germany, but it's part of the same genus. And the goal was to gain control by basically bringing into line the other components of the state, because the White House is only part of the state in political theory terms. Trump had the Oval Office, but he didn't really control the Congress. Even with the Republicans dominant in Congress, most of the Republicans were products of the liberal democratic system. They weren't. They didn't have represent the same movement as Trump or the same ideology. But of course they had to. They went after the national security state and the media first. They also challenged the legal system, challenged judicial review, went after the education system. It was very, very systematic at first, and of course, changing the immigration laws. All of this is sort of racism, racial ideology was used to enlist support from Trump's base in these actions. But it was basically the attacks on the various sectors of the state. They went after the scientists and within the Environmental Protection Agency and the Department of Energy and so on, went after any kind of climate science. It was very serious. And it was, they failed in some respects in this strategy because they went after the national security state, and the national security state sort of fought back, or what that's sometimes called the deep state, the intelligence community, because Trump challenged some of the norms with respect to U.S. imperialism, U.S. military, U.S. wars, and geopolitics. And, of course, you know all about Russiagate and everything else. And the strategy, the initial strategy, wasn't entirely successful. And the influence of this this revolt has been confined largely to the White House, and not it hasn't been able to they haven't been able to extend it beyond the executive as much as they wanted to. Bannon eventually was out. The strategy now, of course, is to attack, is to change the Congress itself, and so you have Bannon supporting Ray Moore in Alabama, who looks like he's going to be the next senator from Alabama, even though he says that homosexual conduct should be illegal and is really a fascist by anybody's definition. The Bannon supporting, you know, Jeff Flake just said he's retiring in Arizona because he was going to lose in re-election. Bannon supporting Kelly Ward, who is another rabid anti-immigration, build-the-wall neo-fascist. And so they're working on the strategy from that angle. They're trying to strengthen Trump's base within the whole political sphere. So these are the kinds of things that are happening at this point.
John, the New York Times had several stories last week on Flake and the speech that he gave on the floor of the Senate. And they talked about not just Flake criticizing what's going on, but McCain, ex-President Bush. Flake was quite alarmed by what's going on, and he said, "We have given in or given up on the core principles in favor of a more viscerally satisfied anger and resentment. To be clear, anger and resentment that people feel at the royal mess that we've created are justified, but anger and resentment are not a governing philosophy." And I think that Flake hit the nail on the head. Anger and resentment may not be a governing philosophy for him, but that's the governing philosophy of Trump and his people. Wouldn't you agree?
Yeah, Flake was a conservative, obviously, and right-wing in his own way. You can't call Flake a liberal, although Bannon might. You know, he represented the old core Republican Party that represented the economic elites, and that would appeal to the lower middle class, but really represented directly the interests of power. But the political movement associated with Trump, this neo-fascism, is rooted in the anger of the lower middle class, the white lower middle class. And Flake retired because he was going to he was clearly going to lose. He could not win an election in these circumstances. So he is making a statement, but it's in the context of what was for him very clearly a political defeat, going to be a political defeat. And I think we have to understand the power of this movement that's developing on the right. it's not something that you can address simply in moral terms, although that's an important factor. You actually have to understand this in class economic terms and in more sophisticated political terms than people are currently doing. It's often talked about as though this is an aberration, that this is just a bunch of racists, that Trump is sort of, it's an accident. None of this is very useful. What's useful is to understand just how powerful this political movement is on the right. They're calling it a national populist movement, or a nationalist populist movement in Breitbart. And this is very powerful, and it's a result of the economic stagnation in the United States, the effects on the lower middle class, its effect, the decline of U.S. hegemony in the world economy. All of these things are part and parcel of this. And people like Bannon actually have a very sophisticated analysis of this in economic and political terms.
The title of your book is Trump in the White House, Tragedy and Farce. Extremely good book. I urge everybody to get Trump in the White House. And Heidi and I thank you for being on the radio show.
Well, thank you so much for having me.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss.
The spectacle of Donald Trump and the palace intrigue in the White House has served daily to distract people from the political strategy and accomplishments of the radical right, which is taking over the Republican Party. Over time, the GOP has been transformed into an operation conducting a concerted effort to curb Democratic rule in favor of capitalist interests in every branch of the government, whatever the consequences. It is marching ever closer to the ultimate goal of reshaping our Constitution to protect moneyed interests. This gradual takeover of a major political party happened steadily over several decades and often in plain sight. Duke Professor Nancy McLean exposes the architecture of this change and its ultimate aim. She has written that, quote, "Both my research and my observations as a citizen lead me to believe American democracy is in peril." Her book, Democracy in Chains, The Deep History of the Radical Right's Stealth Plan for America, has become an intellectual flashpoint and caused her to become the victim of a coordinated right-wing attack. She tells the long-overlooked story of James Buchanan, the political economist who developed the playbook for Charles Koch and his brother and their web of billionaires and millionaires who, beginning in the mid-2000s, have become a force to reckon with. To talk about the subversion of our democratic system from within is Professor Nancy McLean.
Nancy McLean, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you. I'm happy to be with you.
The Republican Party has been transformed both locally and nationally. It's no longer the party that, as you wrote, my father used to vote for. Today we're hoping to explore how the Republican Party has become an instrument of the far right. You argue that key to this story, what you call the missing piece, is understanding the rise of the billionaire radical right and its radical impact on our politics. There's a man named James McGill Buchanan. Tell us about him and how you learned about him.
Yes, well, what I learned is that James McGill Buchanan's ideas are what enabled Charles Koch to break through in his quest for radical transformation of our institutions after decades of pretty much ineffectual work on the margins. James McGill Buchanan was the first Nobel Prize winner to have been born in the U.S. South and to have worked most of his life in Southern institutions. He was the founder of a new school of thought called public choice economics, which is actually a broader tradition that includes people like Cass Sunstein, who worked for President Obama, and others. But his particular variant of that public choice school was the Virginia School of Political Economy, and he was always preoccupied with critiquing democracy as it existed in his early years, and then ultimately with prescribing measures by which it could be, in his words, enchained. And it was those ideas that Charles Koch picked up.
And what did Koch do to fund Buchanan? Can you talk a bit about the network of organizations and think tanks that Koch has set up?
Yes. Well, Koch, for years, was the single biggest funder on the radical libertarian right by a long stretch. So anybody who was on the libertarian right and looking for money went to Charles Koch. Now, James Buchanan, from his first years in Virginia in the late 1950s, had also broader corporate backing from some of the corporations often associated with the radical anti-New Deal right, you know, some of the fossil fuel companies, General Electric, and so forth. But by the late 1990s, 1997 in particular, Koch had become very frustrated with the inability of his minoritarian cause to make progress, and so he began to invest in a big way in Buchanan's center at the George Mason University. And since then, the center at George Mason has become the kind of academic base camp of this radical right. So the economics department there, something called the Mercatus Center, and the now renamed Scalia School of Law are all important components in the Koch-backed effort to transform the country. And they've actually become pipeline, and Koch asked for this. He wanted a kind of talent pipeline. He always said that their greatest problem was the shortage of talent. And so what they're doing is setting up institutions, little training centers at various other schools modeled on this George Mason case, where they churn out and train young operatives to go off and staff the various pieces of the apparatus, which now is huge. I mean, it is literally dozens and dozens of organizations, actually hundreds if you take into account all the affiliates of the State Policy Network and the international affiliates of something called the Atlas Network. So this is a huge operation, larger than either political party, and quite determined to affect radical change in our country.
What is Koch, you know, who I think you write is the seventh most wealthy person in America, what is Koch and his cohorts, what is their vision of a future society?
Well, it's very interesting what they say when they're trying to put their vision out popularly. Is they talk a lot about liberty. They sometimes even then now call themselves the freedom movement. They talk about limited government and low taxes. But if you actually look at the works that most influenced Koch in his construction of that vision, and you look at what some of the people say in their own words our country would look like after success, what you see is an America that would be unrecognizable to your listeners. It's a place in which the three functions of government are maintaining the national defense, overseeing the rule of law, and ensuring social order. And beyond that, we are individually responsible for all of our needs. So ultimately, in their dream world, we have no Social Security, we have no Medicare, we have no public education. What we have instead is a great pressure for us to save as soon as we are sentient beings for our own future needs. And if we fail to save and fail to provide for them, then tough luck. We will be examples to others of what happens when you do not save. And I think you're seeing an enactment, if you will, of this vision in the discussion over health care. And, you know, Americans of both parties are wondering why it is that the Senate is, you know, rushing to push through the repeal of Obamacare and a health, you know, they've had different incarnations, but basically proposed policies that don't get more than 20% support in any poll. Usually it's about 12. They don't have majority support in any state in the country. And it's horrible in the view of most Americans. And yet the donor class is putting pressure on these Republican politicians to make them toe the line, or they will face a primary challenge, and forcing them to vote for something that their own constituents don't want. So it's actually gone so far, this transformation of the Republican Party into a delivery vehicle, that that party is pushing through the agenda of its wealthiest, most extreme right donor class rather than it's the voters whose support it needs to continue as a political party.
Well, they've targeted the state. Trump's main advisor, Steve Bannon, has said that he wants to destroy the state. One of his allies, Grover Norquist, famously said that he wants to shrink the government down to the size that it's so small that it can be drowned in a bathtub. What is their strategy to take down the liberal state?
Well, that is where Buchanan's ideas came in. And whereas other people in this, some of your listeners might refer to them as neoliberal, others free market fundamentalists, whereas others in that milieu, like Milton Friedman and Friedrich Hayek, concentrated more on making the case for free markets, James Buchanan spent his career making the case against government and basically trying to take down, in his words, the understanding of public interest that prevailed at mid-century, the idea that all politicians should be seeking the public interest and all political actors, and then we'd try to persuade one another of our case for what that public interest was. And Buchanan instead looked at the incentives in politics. And so he focused particularly on how different groups made demands on public officials, or, also corporations made demands on public officials and elected officials, and those elected officials, in his terms, would have a self-interest in re-election, so that they would try to, appease multiple constituencies without worrying about the cost. And so he did have a very original interpretation of where deficits came from. Now, what the Koch team has done is taken his ideas and turned them into a strategy for kind of retrofitting American government. So the first part of that is to break down all the progressive groups that made demands on the state that would lead to taxation and any transfer of resources from one, section of the population to another. So all the radical attacks we've seen on unions in the last few years fall into this pattern. They're also attacking the American Association of Retirement People and trying to stir young people up against older people to say older people are getting money as they shouldn't. So lots of efforts to break up groups, also to privatize public resources and services. So they want to privatize ultimately social, in the name, they're saying reform, but they're not questioned about what they mean about that. But what they really ultimately want is the privatization of Social Security and Medicare, public lands, all the rest. And they want to do a whole series of radical policy changes that we probably don't have time for. But the key thing to know is they also want to lock those changes into constitutional amendments, both at the state level and the federal level. So they're actually pushing toward a constitutional convention, which we have not seen in this country since 1787, achieve what the donor class would like to achieve and cannot achieve through the regular political process. And they've actually been extremely successful in gaining control of state governments. They now have full control over 25 states, both houses of the legislature and the governorship. And they're using those states to, in a sense, kind of trap the federal government and prevent the federal government from enacting workable progressive reforms, as they did with the Affordable Care Act, with not accepting Medicaid expansion. So it's a pretty radical vision. It's extremely strategic. And I argue in the book that you can't understand this strategy or its code without understanding the ideas of this guy, James McGill Buchanan.
Nancy, you made the statement that, quote, both my research and my observations as a citizen lead me to believe American democracy is in peril. Can you talk a bit about that? And is that why you wrote this wonderful book?
Yes. I feel like, in some ways, all of what I've been saying kind of points to that conclusion that our democracy is in peril. You can see this in many ways. I mean, I live in North Carolina now, one of the states that has been a laboratory for this, and it has just been utterly, radically transformed by this cause. And we could also point to things that we haven't talked about yet, like the extreme voter suppression bills, which they also want to lock into the Constitution at a constitutional convention. Voter suppression, extreme gerrymandering, refusal to abide by customary procedures in terms of transparency and full disclosure and proper hearings and so forth. It is just such a radical vision. And, I know maybe some of your listeners will think that I am, Chicken Little or something, and that it couldn't possibly be that bad. And there I just have to say that I was, as I was researching this book, so often I would just discover another wing of this, a deeper set of connections, and literally feel nausea, you know, as I was going through the sources or, you know, going through these websites. It just at the scope of this thing, it is huge, and it is very determined, it is very strategic, and I don't think people on the left adequately understand that at all. There's too much mocking of Trump's tweets and his foibles and his intelligence and so forth when this thing is really, really moving forward, and moving forward at an incredible pace in his administration while people are focused on his tweets and, again, his foibles. So, yes, I absolutely wrote this book as I did, in the way that I did, and in the speed that I did, because I really believe that we are at one of those forks in the roads that will determine what kind of society we will be for the next several generations. It is, in my mind, akin to the Civil War and Reconstruction, to the Great Depression of the 1930s, to the struggles of the 1960s. You know, whether the forces who believe in robust and inclusive democracy will come through this stronger, or whether those who believe in restricting the electorate, that democracy is a danger to private property, and that we need a more actually harsh government, whether they will succeed is, we can't know right now. It will all depend on what people do. But I will say the single most important lesson that I hope that people take from reading my book is that this cause, this Koch-backed libertarian cause, is doing what it's doing in the ways that it's doing it because they know from repeated experience that they will never persuade a majority of their views. And so they have to go at it in this side way, what Koch has called the technology of transformation. And I think that if the vast majority of Americans understood what this cause wants, and if they understand what it wants and they reactivate their kind of civic institutions, turn off their electronics and commit to the political process, then I think that this cause will be defeated because, again, it is a small minority, but it's an extremely wealthy and determined and ideological minority.
We've been speaking with Nancy McLean, a professor at Duke, who wrote the terrific book, Democracy in Chains, The Deep History of the Radical Right Stealth Plan for America. Nancy, I can't tell you how grateful Heidi and I are for your good work on this, and we're so pleased to be able to interview you. I wanted to ask you about Gloria Steinem had observed after Trump was elected and put all these people into cabinet positions, all these far-right people. She said that he found a fox for every chicken coop.
And, that's a brilliant quote.
And that's certainly true. And I wanted your reaction to the nature of the cabinet and how it relates to the Koch project.
Yes. That is just a perfect quote and vintage Steinem, and it really captures the situation. There is actually less light, I think, between the Koch operations and the Trump administration than we've been led to believe. At the very minimum, he is looking to them for so many of his top appointments. The people who are in pivotal places come out of these, not out of the mainstream of the Republican Party, to the extent that there is a mainstream anymore, but what they would call the Republican establishment. But rather out of these Koch-led operations, which I said, you know, there are now, you know, dozens and dozens of these, but there are some particularly key ones, and those key ones have supplied many of Trump's senior leaders. By one researcher's calculation, about 70% of Trump's senior appointees come from these Koch operations, are veterans of it. So that's a pretty stunning figure for what was once a kind of a marginal part of the political spectrum. But they include certainly Mike Pence, his vice presidential candidate, who's deeply rooted in these operations. They include Mark Short, who is his the White House liaison to Congress, who's a key pivot person for legislation, and he actually comes out of Freedom Partners, which was the, you know, is the big dark money operation that the Koch, you know, donor network that the Kochs have run. So he knows very well what the donors want, and presumably can convey that to Congress. Who else? Scott Pruitt at the EPA is deeply, you know, involved, has been deeply involved in these Koch operations, and particularly their, you know, fossil fuel protection work and efforts to prevent any action on climate change. Even Mike Pompeo, the head of the CEO, comes out of these Kansas operations. Certainly Kris Kobach, who's directing the new voter suppression effort. I mean, the list just goes on and on. It is really, really striking how many key people. Mick Mulvaney, the budget director, is another one. So this is really an administration that is, in many ways, I would say, other than perhaps the president himself, a dream administration for the Kochs to achieve their agenda. Oh, and you mentioned Steve Bannon before and his desire to, as he puts it, deconstruct the administrative state. Well, somebody who represents that project in the Scalia School of Law at George Mason, Naomi Rao, was just named to a key agency that most citizens won't pay attention to, but is extremely important for regulation, and that is the Office of Information and Regulatory Affairs, OIRA. So, yes, there is definitely a fox presiding over every chicken coop.
Nancy,
and Betsy DeVos, we didn't even talk about her.
Nancy, speaking of dark money, a number of reviewers have placed your book as the companion to Jane Mayer's Dark Money. Do you think this is accurate?
Well, I'm honored by the comparison. Jane Mayer has done hugely important work as a journalist for the American people in first drawing our attention to the Koch brothers and her articles for The New Yorker some years ago. She wrote a brilliant article about my own state, North Carolina, called State for Sale, that focused on the Koch partner, Art Pope, who has led the effort within North Carolina. And her book is terrific at just, you know, showing readers that money trail and all of the things that it is funding. So I'm honored to be in that company, and I see my work as providing the story of the ideas behind this effort and how they have evolved over time, and also helping people to understand the mid-century Southern roots of all of this, that really the dream vision of this cause is, in a sense, to take us back to mid-century Virginia, I say, minus the segregation, and mid-century Virginia was the most oligarchic state in the country with extreme voter suppression, extreme gerrymandering, you know, a parsimonious provision for public needs despite its wealth, starving public school system, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So I have the story of the ideas and also of the legal angle, which is all important to understanding this, and also what the ultimate end game of these ideas is. So yes, I have been many ordinary readers are connecting Jane Mayer and I in their communications, and I'm flattered by the connection.
Nancy, your book, Democracy Unchained, has become an intellectual flashpoint, and you've been subjected to a torrent of abuse for that. For example, I understand that Jonah Goldberg, a senior editor at the National Review, threatened you, writing that you should worry about the, quote, libertarian super posse on my ass. What is the method of operation of the right-wingers who are going after you?
Yeah, it's very interesting. You know, I actually predicted in the book, I said, you know, in the later chapters, and I pointed to the case of Jane Mayer and climate scientists who have brought inconvenient truths to the public for this cause and been subjected to various efforts to smear them. So, you know, it's all... I felt that it was predictable and that I should anticipate it because this is how this cause plays, and their willingness to abuse power is part of my thesis. So, in a sense, they're confirming it. But still, it is pretty stunning to see how deeply the contemporary right has degraded our public discourse, you know, in quotes like the one that you read, you know, coming from the senior editor of a you know, widely read publication. And it's also kind of shocking how intellectually irresponsible so many are, in the sense that most of the people who started critiquing my book, by their own admission, had not read the book. You know, they had read something, they'd found one piece that they might know about to try to, you know, impugn my credibility. So, to be honest, I don't really take them that seriously. I think they're proving to the American people the thesis that I argue in the book about how anti-democratic this cause is, and I'm much more engaged with the real readers who have responded so well to the book and to the, you know, various kinds of mainstream publications, from The Atlantic to The Guardian to Slate to New Republic to I can't even keep track of them all, Alternet, you know, many others. have actually, their reviewers have read the book, engaged the book, and been excited by it. And those are the people I really care to reach and to talk with.
Nancy, James Buchanan actually traveled to Chile after the military coup in 1973 to advise General Augusto Pinochet's military dictatorship after the Chilean military, with instigation and aid from the American government, overthrew the democratically elected government of socialist Salvador Allende. Buchanan helped with suggestions on the economy and on how the dictatorship's constitution could be change so that it would make it very hard to abolish some of the clauses in the Constitution that enshrined private property. Do the far-right Republicans today want to change the American Constitution?
Yes, I believe that they do. And, yeah, it's very interesting. When Milton Friedman went, you know, the Nixon administration was still in power, and the Nixon administration had aided in the coup. By the time that James Buchanan went, his people had carried out an assassination in the streets of Washington, D.C. It was an international pariah. You know, the news of the brutality of the dictatorship had become common knowledge. And it was in that point in 1980 that Buchanan went to advise on this new constitution with which the dictatorship could get the radical changes that it wanted and had effected while under a military junta, so it could get those radical changes perpetuated after a transition to civilian rule, which the whole international community was pushing for. So Buchanan's contribution was arguably much more permanent and lasting and chilling in my mind. In any event, yes, the perceived success that the right enjoyed in Chile, and particularly, again, this neoliberal, if you want to call them right, I call them the property supremacist right, you can think about them in different ways, but they were pleased by what happened in Chile, and that is absolutely what they're trying to bring to the United States and, frankly, to other parts of the world as well. Buchanan said at one point that no constitution in the world protected the rights of the minority, and by that he always really meant the wealthy minority, adequately. And by that that measure, all existing constitutions are failures. Now, you got to think about that. No place in the world captures your ideal. So this is like a radical utopian libertarian right, but because of this billionaire power that is behind it and its capacity to hire, you know, literally thousands of operatives to move this agenda, it is on the verge of radically transforming our institutions and our legal system. So yes, they have invested mightily in changing the law through the various, you know, the kind of law and economics programs to undermine the case for regulation, through constitutional, investing in constitutional scholars who would want to bring us back to, you know, what legal scholars would call the Lochner era, what I also remember as the Plessy era, a time of extreme dominance of capital and extreme suppression of democracy. And they are beginning to achieve that bit by bit around the country. They're talking about putting, you know, voter ID in the federal constitution, putting balanced budget amendments in the federal constitution so as to undermine, you know, programs like Social Security and Medicare. You can just go on. I mean, they have at least 10 different amendments that they want to get through if they get this constitutional convention. And because of their control over state, so many state governments, you know, while the eyes of the left were focused on Washington and various personalities, because of that structural power, they are, by their own lights, close to success.
I think that the other alarming success they've had is within the legal system and the kind of judges that they're getting appointed, the last one being Neil Gorsuch. But if they stack that, then we're really in trouble.
And can I just add, Michael, that was actually a product of the Federalist Society, who groomed students for decades, conservative, to have them placed in judicial positions and higher up positions.
And you won't be surprised to know at this point that Koch was an early funder of that
effort.
Exactly. Yes.
Right.
Yes, and has funded the Institute for Justice and a lot of these organizations that seem so marginal in their legal thinking that I think many legal scholars don't take them seriously. But again, because of the power they've achieved and the fact that they've been able to get cases to the Supreme Court and score some significant victories, they are really important to watch. And another thing, actually, that I think is important for people to know is that this Koch-led libertarian cause has also politicized, is also working to politicize judicial elections and to pump unheard-of amounts of cash into state judicial races to ensure that the state courts sign off on the radical changes that they're making in policies in states like, again, my own North Carolina. So, again, this is highly strategic. It is very well thought out. There are people playing a long game with a very frightening end game, and it behooves all of us to understand it as best we can.
I wanted to ask you, on a personal note, if we might, how did you get political, and how would you define your politics?
Well, I got political. I was, you know, I was born in 1959, and so I was a child, you know, when the civil rights movement was on television and the war in Vietnam was on television, and I was a reader, and so I was always, you know, moved by things. But my first activism was in college when apartheid was in place in South Africa, and there was an anti-apartheid movement on campuses, and that was the first thing that really made me wake up and say, wow, this is wrong, you know, I need to do something. So I've always, you know, been a progressive person. I believe in democracy deeply. I believe in fairness, and that keeps me going and connecting to people who are also working for those things through writing this book has just been a source of joy. I mean, I can't tell you how many great people in the trenches or who are starting to pay attention to politics who hadn't before and who are reading the book and writing to me, how energizing that is. I feel like there's a great kind of weariness in America right now, I think, with people having felt bullied and having felt like their system is changing and it's not responsive and they don't understand why. And as they start to understand what's happening and why, more and more people are finding ways to get involved and to try to challenge this and to reverse this. And so so that's just been really exciting to me. I just love to see grassroots leadership and people finding their voices. That's very sustaining for me.
Very moving, Nancy. Nancy McLean has written a wonderful book, which we heartily recommend to you, called Democracy in Chains, The Deep History of the Radical Right Stealth Plan for America. Nancy, it's just a tremendous contribution you've made. Heidi and I are grateful to you, and we've loved this interview, and we wish you all the luck. Are you going to be on tour? How do people get in touch with you so that we can know if you're speaking somewhere and people can come out and hear you?
Oh, thank you so much. And it has been such a pleasure talking to you guys. You have such an amazing show. If people go to the Penguin Random House book page for Democracy in Chains, they'll see a little orange logo that says On Tour, and the tour spots are starting to be put in there. And it's not a full listing yet, you know, so if you don't see your city represented, you could contact the press or contact me and see if anything is being organized there. But at this point, I'd say we have a couple dozen venues and places in the works, and so hopefully I'll get to an area where I can talk to some of your wonderful listeners.
Nancy, it's been an honor to have you on. Congratulations on a truly remarkable and timely book, Democracy in Chains.
Thank you so much, Heidi, and thank you, Michael.
You take it easy.
Take care. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
If you have any comments or questions about this segment or any others, please visit us at lawanddisorder.org.